dreams, yet my dreams remain. I won't fade away, no matter the strain. I'll keep on singing in silence, though no one hears. The road is rough, though I never give up. Reaching for the stars, though they feel out of reach. Pushing through the shadows, stepping into the limelight. Someday I will rise and succeed. The world will hear my voice.
On a warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns staring out the window at the darkness. The boredom overtook us, and he began to speak. He said, "Son, I've made my life out of reading people's faces and knowing what the cards were by the way they held their eyes. So if you don't mind me saying, I can see you're out of aces. For a taste of your whiskey, I'll give you some advice." So I handed him my bottle, and he drank down my last swallow. Then he bummed a cigarette and asked me for a light. And the night got deathly quiet, his face lost all expression. Said, "If you're gonna play the game, boy, you gotta learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for count when the dealing's done." Now every gambler knows the secret to surviving is knowing what to throw away, knowing what to keep. 'Cause every hand's a winner and every hand's a loser, and the best you can hope for is to die in your sleep. So when he'd finished speaking, he turned back toward the window, crushed out his cigarette, faded off to sleep. Then somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. But in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold 'em,
when to hold 'em,
know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the deal's done.
Madison.
And we're going to be talking about the topic of the week for this week on the anarchistnews.org podcast on the website.
And it's called Meaningful OPSEC, or Now You Don't Have a Personal FBI Agent. I've been considering operational security and security culture a lot since the Turtle Island Liberation Front case broke. For such a small group, about seven people, two were feds. Well, one was a paid informant. The other was an FBI agent. I am reminded of the joke myth of a CPUSA meeting that a federal infiltrator attends in order to arrest the attendees. Then all the other members are also feds. Cue the laugh track. Despite the colossal fuck-up of being infiltrated, TILF had a plan that seemed based on strong OPSEC. From the United States District Court for the Central District of California, the plan described multiple operational security measures the co-conspirators should take to conceal their identities, such as the use of a burner phone that would be disposed of after the bombings by, quote, submerging it in a concrete brick after destroying the SIM and then disposing of the brick in a body of water, and the use of black block over top of a layer of gray casual block on top of normal street clothes, and noted to keep hair very tightly concealed and to wear gloves for the purpose of avoidance of leaving behind DNA. Further, participants should leave their personal devices at home and to make sure the devices were set up to stream a long movie during the time of the attack so as to craft an alibi. Even a pebble in the show to alter their walking and material acquisition advice to avoid suspicion were discussed. A question I am stuck on is how can you have thought through these particular aspects of prep work and on-the-ground OPSEC and allow yourself to be infiltrated by two feds? As a friend said, because their security was missing the trees for the forest. From Crime Thinks, what is security culture? The difference between protocol and culture is that culture becomes unconscious, instinctive, and thus effortless. Once the safest possible behavior has become habitual for everyone in the circles in which you travel, you can spend less time and energy emphasizing the need for it, or suffering the consequences of not having it, or worrying about how much danger you're in, as you'll know you're already doing everything you can to be careful. It seems, from what is available, TILF had strong protocols for their Operation Midnight Sun, but not a real culture to develop secure, safe relationships to avoid infiltration. They posted calls for direct action and revolution on social media, one that was easily connected to a member of TILF, and thus the radical section that sought to do the attack. They let relatively new people into the plan, the informant and later the FBI agent. The difference in attitudes about security by the same people is striking. By having a strong focus, and in the case of TILF, reasonable ones in regard to the plan, on only some parts of security culture and not a whole picture, you leave gaps in the culture. For most people, this is, well, the feds are watching, and thus their security culture centers that primary concern, as opposed to it being part of a wider network of concerns. And let us be real, most of us do not have the feds particularly watching our actions or groupings outside of the concerns of a general surveillance state. This all comes at the expense of, say, local cops, right-wing agitators, or the common person who may overhear or see something they shouldn't. So while TILF did have personal FBI agents inside their network, it was because of a failure of their security culture leading up to that point. Had it been a stronger culture, maybe, quote, Operation Midnight Sun would have been another CNN news segment we'd forget by the next day. What security concerns do you find are most overlooked in anarchist circles? What about overdone? How are security concerns changing in light of the development of companies like Flock Safety, Oracle, and Palantir? What are ways security culture and protocols change between anarchist groupings, particularly those separated by geography, in different cities or countries? It's interesting that this is coming out right now because I'm thinking a lot about the difference between security culture and operational security. So I'm happy about this topic of the week.
What have you been thinking about it?
Well, I mean, I feel like the author of the topic of the week kind of sums it up. It's like operational security is the measures that someone takes for a particular action, whereas the culture of security allows people to get away with more because there's a culture around need to know and this kind of thing.
Yeah, I like drawing the distinction. I don't know if it was so clear to me, but what you're saying, it makes a lot of sense. I think that's helpful. I think sometimes the two things are used as like synonyms.
Yeah, and like my understanding of the principles of security culture, maybe it would be helpful to talk about them. There's a culture of non-cooperation, so not working with law enforcement or making it easier for them.
Not snitching, etc.
Minimizing gossip, rumors, boasting, and speculation, particularly about illegal events, but you know, a lot of security culture is a response to COINTELPRO and how power exploited those vulnerabilities, right? So gossiping and like spreading rumors is a way of is looked down upon in a security culture. There's need to know, so you only need to know things that directly are relevant to you. I think that with security culture, safety is not necessarily the goal, but it's a way to protect activities more. And so, another thing that can be added to security culture is to address people's behavior rather than snitch jacket them, or like just think like hypothesize about who they are or why they're doing the thing, but just talk about like so in other words, not speculating about motives, but like naming behavior that is against the ethics of the culture. And then I think another thing I think about with security culture is having transparency about interactions that law already knows about. So like if there's knocks or these kinds of things. And then just yeah, not letting security culture become its own shortcoming. Like so that the bar for participation is so high that like the culture becomes so high context that you can't be in it.
What do you mean?
High context culture is like when the values and like behaviors of participants are so like how do you even talk about it? It's an anthropology term, actually. And it refers to the types of behaviors that show to certain cultures what like whether you belong to them. So like there's that famous quote by an infiltrator or something that's like, oh man, it's so hard to infiltrate anarchists. They read so many books.
There's zines, I think,
Or it
was the
was
thing.
zines or something. So it's like, yeah, there's so much that you have to know in order to be accepted or whatever. And I bet that's changing with social media and stuff, you know, but that has been historically the case.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not that critical of creating more barriers to entry. I think I'm like I take I when I heard that quote, I don't even remember where it came from. But when I heard that, I was like, I felt a lot of pride.
Well, yeah, me too, of course.
And so I don't I would prior I don't know, I mean there's something there's definitely a balance, but I wouldn't like I think personally I do prioritize. Fuck, I don't even know. Well, I'm not so critical about having things be unclear when you first get into something. I guess because this also comes from my experience of like taking part in subcultures or countercultures that like when you first get in, you're like, what the fuck is going on? And everyone just treats you like a dummy for like a couple of years. And then you figure it out if you like it enough or whatever. And I guess that the I'm reacting to the intention for being very welcoming and open. That comes from more like political or like activist anarchy that are like really want to be hyper inclusive because they are trying to just get as many people in as possible. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay, like I am whatever, like people that know me or the way I see myself, I guess, is that I am generally pretty friendly to people that are like interested in anarchy and things I'm a part of. But I also am okay with them having to put in effort to like understand things, and that it's not just going to be all. Yeah. And I think it does serve a bit of a security role.
Yeah, but you're conflating two things that I didn't say.
Can you explain?
Yeah, you're reacting, I believe, to the thing of security culture not being its own barrier. And you're what that's I'm not talking about it being hard to entry. I'm saying that like security culture in its own way can be its own like dog whistle or something to other people, like being, you know what I'm talking about, the behaviors where someone's like, let's go for a walk, mm-hmm. like they're implying that they're doing something,
right,
and it becomes its own impediment, like.
Right, the people that can decode that, it, like, says a lot of things.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about, like, that there should be a low threshold for illegality and inclusion.
I see. I feel reactive to that thing
mm-hmm.
because it's so prominent, and so maybe I heard that in what you're saying, but mm-hmm. yeah, totally.
Because I think that sometimes... the performance of security culture breaches security culture.
Right. It can be actually, yeah, right. It's about implying that you're very militant more than it is about protecting yourself or anyone else.
Yeah.
Or it can be.
Yes.
That. Yeah, that's annoying. That's not, I mean, that totally defeats the purpose.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember in the Brilliant podcast, they were kind of joking. I remember about this exact thing you're describing. And I forget who they were like, yeah, okay, like, we get it, you burn something down at one point or whatever. Like, because, like, people will act in this way where it's like, they're just, like, really trying to communicate that they're, like, needing to take extreme precaution and needing to, yeah, just, like, kind of militantly... be militantly secure or something in this way that's like seems like it's actually more about them saying that they like they're really down to do the sketchy shit or whatever mm-hmm. which is like that's totally not the point.
Well, and also like my idea or my understanding of security culture is that there are people who feel more comfortable taking risk and people who don't, but the people who don't want to take the risks can shelter or cover the people who do want to take risks by mm-hmm. like also not having their phones mm-hmm. or also not like participating in these things. And like, that's why it becomes a culture, because not everybody has to adopt the identity of some like, yeah, guerrilla warfare person, mm-hmm. right? Like it's more that, you know, they're gonna... like that you normalize the things that obscure information from the state because that's a cultural value.
Yeah.
Because we're against the state, whether or not you're doing, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It doesn't matter. Like you don't want to be, whatever your life is, if you're an anarchist, you don't want to be legible to the state.
Exactly.
Unless you're using it unless you're subverting it or something, but.
Right, and so I think where people are making compromises about this are, like, very relevantly in social media, right? Where, and I think you're speaking to kind of the crux of it when you talk about the low threshold
mm-hmm.
for entry, that there's a tension between making yourself legible to other potential anarchists, but not legible to the state, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe I don't even see the point of necessarily making yourself legible to other anarchists that you don't know already or something, you know?
I think you do see the point, because what about something like a communique?
Like whether that serves a purpose.
Yeah, or propaganda.
I think some. Okay. I guess it depends what you're trying to make legible. But I'm not. I mean, I'm not even sure about the usefulness of communiques. I don't feel so certain about it always being a thing that's useful. But maybe that's another conversation.
But I'm just saying that the legibility is how these, or maybe I'll put it like this. For a long time, the actions communicate something, and then people speaking for the reasons of their actions have communicated something, right? And the hope of that perhaps is that their actions will be reproducible, that they can be understood, and people will identify with them and like replicate those actions, or they'll see feel seen by the actions of other people and feel inspired to participate.
Yeah, that is that's the insurrectionary anarchist part of it.
I don't think it's just insurrectionary anarchists. I think it's also been useful in like Earth Liberation Front things, or eco-defense in general, or animal
Yeah, I
liberation
guess
things.
I equate it more with that tendency. Totally, yeah, but it's been used across different movements. And yeah, I think we're straying from the plot a little bit, maybe. Yeah, I don't want to get stuck here.
Sure, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that legibility creates, it is sort of like a double-edged sword or something. Like, if illegality in a certain way becomes specialized, then there's fewer number of people who are in the pool of repression, right? But at the same time, making oneself or one's culture legible to the state means that you're more ripe for infiltration.
So I guess may th that's like the balance, right? And I think that each thing one does is like context specific. That like every time you choose to make yourself legible, you're hopefully thinking about the balance of, okay, I'm making myself legible to people that I want to hear what I have to say. But also in doing so, I'm becoming visible to my enemy, and thus the risk increases. And so maybe each situation like warrants, or each decision like warrants that kind of, just thought process, especially if it's like a group of people. But I wouldn't say I don't, I don't think I have like a singular, like this good, this bad position on
No.
something like that. It's more like, yeah, it's like a balancing that is, yeah, I don't know. Like, I've read communiques where I was like, this is interesting. I'm glad I can read people's reasoning for making this choice or whatever. And then I've read ones where I was like, I don't need to read this. And I kind of get it. And it's actually more interesting if I didn't have a whole background thing. It's like more interesting for me to think about the act in itself rather than this person or people's like whole explanation. So I think it's just, again, like depends on what's going on.
Well, right, but if we're talking about this in the context of operational security and security culture, I guess if you're doing a communique, or one is doing a communique, then you're giving more information about, to be analyzed by AI or whatever, about who's doing the authoring.
Totally. I mean, writing a communique is always more sketchy. I don't think there's a, unless you're lying in it, unless you're making stuff up to like get the cops off your trail or whatever, and you're just making random shit up.
I
And
love that story from The Galleanist, where the person wrote a letter, like Nestor Dondoglio, I think. He called himself like Jean Crone or Jean Crone, and like wrote letters to the police, Just like completely misled them and taunted them the whole time.
Yeah, I think that's funny and clever.
Yeah.
Like I would say this, yeah. Sounds pretty, yeah, smart. I don't know. It doesn't. I mean, who knows if anyone's doing that or not? But I generally think that's playful in a cool way. It's an awesome story.
Okay, but we were talking about security culture, and I think one of the biggest tenets of it is like knowing who you're working with closely. And I think that what the author of the topic of the week really catches on is that, like, how did you not know? And I think that things being planned over Signal, things being planned through Instagram DMs or whatever is inherently bad operational security as well as security culture, right? And that, like, knowing people and knowing how they will act under pressure, having context for them, trust being built, is an important part of security culture.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, wait, can we go back to the questions? Because I want to try to, I have stuff to say, but I want to say in response to what you're saying, but also like these questions, I think it fits. Yeah, the first question, what security concerns do you find are most overlooked in anarchist circles? What about overdone? I think that, yeah, I mean, the idea of having a social media presence where you're like, I just think that was like, and I feel a little bad like picking apart these people's shit, because it is ultimately like I'm really bummed that they're facing this level of repression,
Definitely.
and so I don't want to just like shit on them or something, you know. But I do totally disagree with putting yourself out there on social media in that kind of way. And to me that you like my kind of way of looking at security stuff is that, and this is how I was taught it, like pretty early, is that the state or whoever's trying to find people or whatever will go after the lowest hanging fruit first. So when you create an Instagram where you're talking about taking down the US or whatever, and you're posting those things, and they're tied to you, I mean, even if it's more or less impossible to create an Instagram that is not tied to you, and so it should just be assumed that if you have an Instagram, it can be tied back to you if somebody wants, and it's not that difficult. Like that company is also a surveillance company. It is very ready to cooperate with law enforcement and all that. So when you're putting those things on Instagram, you become the lowest hanging fruit. Like all they really have to do is just look at fucking Instagram or ask Instagram to look at the IPs of who created the account, where it's being logged on to and all that stuff, and they can really easily triangulate who you are. Even if you didn't use your real name and phone number. And so, like, especially agencies like FBI that have really intense resources to do that stuff. So, that to me is the thing that's most commonly overlooked in in anarchist circles, is the kind of assumption that you can participate in social media and talk about anarchist intention with any level of security is, I think, totally fucking misled. And I think should be avoided entirely. Yeah, I don't know. And I guess that to me is like, that to me is the first problem. And then talking about Signal again, like, I understand, my understanding is that like Signal is a lot safer than Instagram DMs and all that, enough people have talked about why it's more secure and all that, but like still, like if you're talking about sketchy shit, just assume that doing it through a phone or over any kind of technology is like not safe. Like I think that's just the safest assumptions you can make. Is that if you want to do that, if you want to talk about things like that, don't do it through a fucking phone, whether it's Signal or not. And I mean, there's the whole other problem, because like regardless of if they were following this thing that I'm describing now, or like taking these sorts of precautions, or being kind of like having more caution in these areas, like they still invited an informer into their circles. And I think the reason the informer was interested in them in the first place is because of their social media presence. And yeah, I don't know. But it's, you know, it's like hard. It's hard to know how to avoid that once they want to infiltrate. Like, it's hard how you, I mean, knowing people for a longer time, having people you trust vouch for people that come into your circle. But like, even then people have been infiltrated, like even when they've tried to do those things.
Or like, you know, there's an infiltrator. There's like that whole story about that person in England, I think, who like married an infiltrator. Like, that's devastating.
Yeah, Mark Stone, I think, this is one of the names that he used.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
And then there's like Brandon Darby and like these other people who were infiltrators. So. And then of course there's like the classic, like, people change over time, and like the Operation Backfire story is pretty devastating, of someone like wearing a wire and talking about old things, which is why I think that like security culture is like an important thing to remember, in terms of like, you don't talk about activities in the past,
right?
And if someone comes to you doing that, that's a big red flag.
Yeah, I mean, if there's no reason to you know, it's like, once if you're doing something that would be of interest to fucking some agency like the FBI, like there's no reason to talk about it afterwards, like, you know.
Right,
like,
but we're talking about it from hindsight also.
What do you mean?
Like, the benefit of hindsight, like, we know what happened.
Yeah, but it's happened over and over.
Totally, that's true.
Yeah, it's not like it stopped happening, like people keep doing this, it seems, you know. And yeah, I mean, again, maybe there is some wiggle room or something, because if you're doing something intense with someone, you might want to like discuss how it went or something, or like what you learned, or from what went wrong or didn't, or whatever.
Yeah, but maybe not 10 years later, or however many.
Definitely not 10 years. Why would you need to do that 10 years later? That seems, yeah. No, yeah, you're right. Like, the time, maybe you'd want to do that right after, and then make an agreement that you're never going to talk about it again or whatever.
But I think there's something too about, there's not just a culture of resistance. There needs to be like a culture as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that like people feel, I don't know. I'm trying to not talk about something that I don't know about, but my hypothesis, so I'm just being clear that I don't know about it, but I wonder like if those people were fractured, or they like were feeling separate from like their past, you know. It's like, that's when you feel like you know, susceptible to reminiscing. Like the glory days, the good old days when we used to XYZ thing. You know what I mean? But there's like, if there's a continued culture and people are less atomized, then maybe that's not, it doesn't feel like one has to imagine themselves as previously relevant to a certain kind of resistance. You know what I mean? That's like a rude thing to say, because I don't know what those people were doing. And
but
I,
you could see it.
Yeah.
How that would play out.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. But yeah, to your point of Instagram. I think that also it's a generational thing, because my understanding is that the TILF people are quite young, but I don't know if that to be true, I guess.
I think I remember reading that, but I don't, I don't know for sure if that's true.
Yeah, but if they are, I feel like there is a sort of taken for granted that you just communicate on Instagram. You, like, you show yourself to the world, or there's, like, that has been sort of a, I think it's becoming undone, but for the last 10 years or something, if you, like, there is this kind of, that's just what you do, you know, that I can't relate to.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to get into that, headspace, because I think that is the sort of, like, that's like the water that they're in or something, you know, people who are like Gen Z or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that just speak, I think to me, it speaks more to the benefit of getting off these devices and having, like, I totally agree with you that having a culture is, like, a part of this.
Mm-hmm.
Not just security culture, but, like, a culture. Of, like, a people that, like, feel like they're together or whatever. You know, have, like, a shared lifeway. And I don't think that's going to happen through Instagram. DMs or not. And so, like, whether you're, you know, that's, like, that feels really connected, like, it's not just less secure, you're also, like, you're trying to build community and a culture on top of fucking hyper-surveilled terrain that was designed to fuck your brain up and, like, get you to buy stuff and, like, totally take you away from the living world. And so that just doesn't seem like fertile ground to build a people.
But also, I think that there's something, like, what you're talking about is the is funny to use this word, but the meta picture.
Brought to you by meta.
But the other thing, right, is that I feel like for a long time, people relied on the sheer amount of information that, like, protects them or something. But now we're seeing with AI that you can just, like, algorithmically search for things, keywords that people say, and that's been used and being used currently in criminal court, right? Like, people are, like, prosecution is more and more using algorithmic search tools to, like, damn or, like, find evidence. And so you can no longer take for granted that there's going to be, like, that there's not enough resources for law enforcement to find the specific thing that someone said, or, like, find, you know what I mean? Like, through a conversation history, like, they have the resources now. And it's not just a person who's having to read transcripts of a phone call or something, right? It's like a robot that's, like, mining the conversation for different topics. And I think that that's a really different landscape for prosecution.
Yeah, that speaks to the second question, right? Security, how are security concerns changing in the light of the development of companies like Flock, Oracle, and Palantir? Yeah, that, like, hiding and the sheer volume of information that exists is, like, less and less possible.
Well, yeah, and the integration means that there's not just a concern of, like, someone snitching on themselves or snitching on another person or informant. It's also, like, there is more data, right? Movements are tracked in a different way. And this thing that I keep thinking about is the Wi-Fi blueprint.
Yeah, I mean, most people don't know about that, but that's not being used currently, but it's, like,
it's close.
It's, like, in development.
Yeah.
Do you want to say what that is? Because
I don't understand exactly how it works, but my understanding is that each human's body gives off a unique heat footprint, basically, or like, fingerprint.
Like the Predator.
Yeah, like the Predator. Exactly. And that through Wi-Fi that exists in everyone's homes, that creates, like, a way to view people's movements, whether they have a phone or not. And, like, historically, people are tracked through, like, video surveillance, license plate readers and their own cell phones, right? But now perhaps people will start to be tracked by their heat signature through existing Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
In a city or something. And of course there's like biometrics, and I know that this is like been around forever, but now it's like more, it's like technologically enhanced. That gait is
like how you walk, how you move.
Yeah, is mm-hmm. being analyzed. But then it was interesting to learn that gait has always been described in
mm-hmm.
in descriptions of criminals
mm-hmm.
by the state, classifying them as criminals.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's just gonna like, you know, this really speaks to the like critique of technology as necessarily a tool of repression and control, like that, like as things get more technologically advanced, there's going to be more surveillance, and like so it is always one of the central ways that technology gets used by powerful entities in society is to like control, surveil and control. And so as all this shit, as all this AI, fucking all this bullshit gets developed and kind of becomes more intricate, it also means it's better at catching criminals or people they decide are criminals at the time or whatever, just making sure they know what everyone's doing and can dole out punishment when they see necessary.
Well, it's like the principle of the panopticon, like extended mm-hmm. beyond, right? Like yeah. people police themselves if they feel they're being surveilled.
Yeah, I was just listening to this, totally, yeah, it reminds me, I was just listening to this, like, graffiti podcast, and these people were talking about shoplifting,
mm-hmm.
and I was so disappointed. Like, you know, usually, like, they just really hype up shoplifting and, like, share stories or whatever, and it's, like, really entertaining, and this fool was basically like, oh, well, you know, now you can't really get away with shit shoplifting like how you used to, because the second you walk into a store, there's like cameras and they're all run through AI algorithms and they right away know who you are, and so you can't do shit. And that was such, I was like, you're policing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people are fucking stealing every day from all these stores. Like, if you think that the cameras and all this AI bullshit is so, so fucking successful, then that's totally wrong. Go into any major city and like just hang out outside of a Home Depot or a fucking Target or whatever. You'll see people constantly stealing successfully. And yeah, I mean, you know, in the parking lots now they have those like cameras. That literally looks like a panopticon. It's like the multi-directional dome cameras that are like have a solar panel, and like, yeah, I think that's meant to create that
mm-hmm.
that response that like, oh, I'm being watched. Like, look at all this fucking shit, and it's like got blinking lights and shiny bullshit, and no matter what I do, it knows what I'm doing, so I better not step out of line. But yeah, that's that self-policing shit. Anyway, yeah, I was sad. I was so sad to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but most people aren't on that tip.
Yeah, I think that the topic really speaks to the difference between operational security and security culture as well. Because it does seem like their operational security was taken into consideration,
mm-hmm.
right? How to dispose of materials, how to obscure their identities, how to have an alibi in terms of what their like self-monitoring tools,
mm-hmm.
like phones and stuff, are doing. Yeah. Oh, this was supposed to say even a pebble in their shoe.
Yeah.
See, so they're talking about gait and all this stuff.
Right. Yeah, they were actually, that's like, I've never heard of people trying to, like, I've never heard that talked about.
Yeah.
The pebble thing, that's interesting.
So I think that.
Shit, seems like it'd be harder to run though.
But.
Depends on the pebble, I guess. Yeah, but like, totally, but that is all not very helpful if you are working with the FBI informant.
Right, that's the point that it makes.
That's the problem, yeah.
Yeah, so this I feel perfectly highlights the sort of security culture versus operational
Yeah,
security,
if you
and you need
don't,
to have
right.
both.
If you don't have security culture, then your OPSEC stuff is like totally besides the point. It just doesn't do what it's supposed to at all. It actually creates more evidence.
Exactly.
It looks like you're it looks like you're really premeditated criminal or whatever.
Right, but then there's this whole other confusing and confounding factor where there's these creative prosecution strategies to make people doing very benign things seem like terrorism, right? Like, so we see in the Prairie Land case how they're saying that people just being in a signal group together shows that they're in a quote terrorist cell, and that like I think someone just got indicted on telling people how to delete signal messages. And of course that's in a specific context where someone was on the run and the person was telling them how to delete signal messages as a way to destroy evidence.
Yeah.
And so that has always been illegal in the eyes of the state. But still,
Right.
I think that there's a way that security culture and OPSEC is not. Well, security culture better prepares anarchists or anybody who the state deems as a threat, to prepare themselves for the complete arbitrary, enforcement of these laws, right? And
Yeah.
like we see that, of course, with this is being pointed out all week right now with the stuff in Minnesota where this person who was just executed had a gun. And the state says that, well, it was his fault he had a gun. But you know that, what was his name? Rittenhouse? They were like, he can have a gun. It's open carry, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's completely arbitrary when they enforce these things.
Right.
Well, it's not totally arbitrary.
They
It's
use it when it,
along.
yeah, you, they use it when it benefits them.
Exactly.
In a way that benefits them.
And so I think security culture is much better poised to navigate that kind of arbitrariness than OPSEC. Because OPSEC is a way of securing one's own movements so as to avoid prosecution or evidence. But security culture better poises you, like you don't cooperate with them. You're ready to deal with the fact that they're gonna throw everything at you and try to break your spirit. And so that you crack and snitch on your friends or sign a plea deal that like damns everybody else, right? Like, I think that's the benefit of security culture is that you're creating a culture of resistance where one anticipates that the state will be punishing because they see anarchists as a threat. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess maybe this is an important thing to touch on too, is that I sometimes see this response to repression by anarchists that they're like shocked or something, or like that anarchists are being surveilled and targeted is like shocking to people, or like that if they kind of regard it as really unjust. But I guess from my understanding of the history of anarchists and just people that are against whatever state they're living in, is they are a threat. And so they're if they like position themselves as a threat to an entity, is it is gonna like surveil them and it is gonna treat them as their enemy. I mean, ultimately, anarchists by definition are enemies of the state, And so it shouldn't be surprising when the state treats us as their enemy. And like, I think maybe it gets like lumped in sometimes. People's response maybe gets lumped into the like broader response of, by the left or like by like other resistance movement, usually the left, that are like, what the fuck? Like, why were you watching us? This is supposed to be a democracy or something. It's like kind of the like framing. But like, if you're an anarchist, you should understand that by having that position, you are gonna be a target. And so, like, living your life accordingly is probably helpful rather than like running into repression and then being shocked. Like, you should just understand. I mean, the history of anarchists is like one of prosecution and targeting and like crazy shit. Like, a lot of people have been deported from here and killed and all kinds of stuff just for being anarchists, for not even really doing anything necessarily, you know, just for having that position. And that's like that's becoming once again more common at this time in the United States, but like there's definitely a lot of other examples in the history of this country where that's been true. And like anarchists aren't the only ones that have been targeted so like ruthlessly. And there's other people that have been targeted much more ruthlessly, you know.
With much less Ruth.
What does that
I
mean?
don't know.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Yeah,
Great time to make a joke, though.
I
Fuck. I like that. Yeah. What other questions do we have?
like what you're saying is also that I think it can be really disappointing as anarchists to understand that there's been a certain way that we internalize the myth of progress. That it's like a linear rights being granted, you know, and I see that in people around me. And if I'm honest, like in myself, much less so now, but maybe a few months ago or something, just being like, wow, this is crazy that people are doing this, right? Like I thought, you know, I don't know. I just, that it's good. I think it's important and good to like realize our conditioning. And that sometimes we fall victim to our conditioning, even though we're not trying to.
Yeah, we get too comfortable.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe to speak to that a little more, like the amount that anarchists are stating really intense positions publicly, like the shit when people are like talking about killing cops and stuff on the internet, or like just saying really intense shit is like you are way too fucking comfortable if you're doing that. Like, that's not. I don't think that's chill. Like, I'm not sure what. Or I guess, okay. If you're doing that, understand that you are taking a very serious risk and don't be surprised when they come for you. Because if the state, like, takes you seriously or whatever, like, that shouldn't be surprising. And I think they're definitely. Became like a culture of saying really fucking intense shit on the internet by anarchists that or whatever radicals of different stripes that does feel performative and does feel like people equate being able to say really intense things as some sort of like victory or something, and like maybe an aspect of that, maybe there's like some truth to that, but also it's incredibly risky. And people, again, shouldn't be surprised when they face the like consequences of the risks they're taking. I'm not saying they deserve anything bad to happen to them, but it's just like, yeah, like that's sketchy.
Yeah, it just makes me think that people are willing to assume the risk of technology, or like that they've inter back to this thing of like internalizing certain myths that like technology is neutral, but it's how you use it. And we're just like seeing that that like these technology companies, there's no way for them to be neutral. Like, they're there to push their own agendas, and if that works with the state, then it works with the state. But it's, and right now it is, but like, actually the people who own these tech companies have like as much or more power than the state currently. I mean, they're just part of the state in a certain way, but they also could be adversarial, right? They're not, but like, they have their, they are consolidating power in their own way.
Right. Yeah, there's like sometimes a tension between them, but ultimately I think they're working towards a similar goal of complete subordination of everyone else, and like everyone playing along to whatever the reality they've constructed.
Right, but I think that where this comes with anarchists is they're like, okay, I can, back to the Instagram thing, like I can talk about this stuff because the risk I'm taking, they're assuming the risk that like, if I can get this information to more people, then I'll have safety in numbers, right? Which is like, I think makes sense in a certain way, right? Mm. But I'm just not sure. Like, I wonder if people are reconsidering that position given the sort of, yeah, I don't know, I keep using this word, but like almost arbitrary